Early fresh whole blood saves lives.
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Landers, founding publisher of the JSOM. I'd like to thank you for joining the JSOM's 20th anniversary interview series. We are excited to bring together a host of experts, all leaders in the soft medical community. In these interviews, we will be discussing the ever-evolving methods of treating battlefield trauma and injury and how those methods have changed over the 20 years since the JSOM's inception. I hope you'll find these talks as informative as we do.
And welcome back to our outstanding and educational conversation with Dr. Frank Butler, and we'll pick it up where we left off with going forward. And so then going forward in time, what happened to TC3 after the next big time hack, which was 9/11?
Right. After 9/11, basically the early adopters went to war in Afghanistan with tactical combat casualty care. Everybody else in the U.S. military, and that was the vast majority of forces, including most of the special operations community, went to war without TC3. The other important thing that happened in 2001 is that the committee on TC3 was established so that we could keep it current in the years going forward.
And so maybe you could go into that a little bit further and tell us about the COTSI and how it got started.
Right. So trauma care concepts, like everything else in medicine, changes over time. TC3 will always be a work in progress, so there needed to be a way to update the TC3 guidelines based on new information and based on feedback from TC3 users, the combat medics, corpsmen, and PJs. And this was mentioned in the original TC3 paper that had a recommendation that the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs should establish a standing panel tasked with the development and periodic review of battlefield trauma care guidelines. The panel should monitor new developments in the field of pre-hospital trauma and incorporate them into updated guidelines which are appropriate for the tactical battlefield environment. In other words, now that TC3 was going, the job was to keep it going. The U.S. SOCOM Medical Research Program was a logical organization to fund the COTSI, but interestingly, they wouldn't do that at first. Several U.S. SOCOM command surgeons just did not believe that this project was specific to special operations, and they felt that one of the services should fund it. The counter to that is special operations medics are trained like no others, and they operate in environments like no others, so it really was special to special operations. And finally, Dave Hammer became the U.S. SOCOM surgeon, and Colonel Hammer greenlighted this project. The challenge then was to find someone willing to take our U.S. SOCOM research money. You wouldn't think that would be too much of a challenge, but amazingly, it was. For whatever reason, most military labs and organizations did not want to take this on. Finally, the Navy Operational Medical Institute stepped up. Captain Doug Freer, God bless him, was the commanding officer there at the time. Captain Steve Gibner was the hyperbarics officer at the Navy Operational Medical Institute, and he agreed to be the first chairman. He had previously been the Naval Special Warfare Force Medical Officer, so he knew the topic. Neither Captain Freer nor Captain Gibner got any extra financial reward for taking on the duties of administering the COTSI. They did this in addition to their regular duties. And in addition to that, Captain Freer took the remarkable initiative to get COTSI into his command's POM, the long-term budget, which was a great step because that kept it going and the years going forward. So the next step was for Captain Gibner and I to select the first 29 people to be the charter members of the COTC. We picked people from all of the services, trauma surgeons, emergency medicine, critical care physicians, operational physicians, and PAs. And very importantly, we picked combat medics, corpsmen, and PJs to be part of the group and to help us be creators of the guidelines and not just users of the guidelines. Again, all of these people took on their duties in the COTC in addition to their regular day jobs, so they were incredibly generous with their time and expertise. The charter of this group was to maintain an active search for good ideas wherever they could be found and then process them as though lives depended on it, because indeed they do. The committee would talk through the ideas. The ones with merit would be proposed as changes to the guidelines, and every change to be accepted had to be passed by a supermajority of the members, which was an important step because it kept things into the category of strongly recommended rather than taking something that was an even split of the committee. And I would emphasize that the committee very proactively engaged on new ideas, both good and bad, from anywhere that they could be found. You may have heard the saying, lead, follow, or get out of the way. Colonel Kevin O'Connor from the Army Special Missions Unit, and later the White House Medical Office, was one of our charter members, and he put the approach of the COTC on new trauma care ideas this way. Sometimes we've led, sometimes we've followed, but we've never just gotten the hell out of the way.
Fascinating. And so how did TC3 become the standard of care for U.S. Special Operations Command?
You know, much of the credit for that goes to Colonel John Holcomb and the U.S. Army Institute of Surgical Research, which I'll call ISR for short. I arrived as command surgeon at U.S. SOCOM in April of 2004. And one of the first things that needed to be done was to review all of the deaths that had occurred in SOF in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I brought this research need to Colonel Holcomb's attention and asked that a study be done to answer this question. And Colonel Holcomb, as always, was all over it. He put together a team that included Dr. Howard Champion, Captain Jim Caruso from the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System, Rocky Farr and Master Sergeant Sammy Rodriguez from USASOC, and others. So we pulled the autopsy file of every single SOF warrior that had been killed in Afghanistan and Iraq since the beginning of the wars, all the way through November of 2004. We reviewed their findings at autopsy to determine if the death could have been prevented, if the medical care had been better or faster. And we found that 70 of the 82 deaths, 85%, were non-preventable given the injuries that had been sustained. But the other 12 deaths might have been prevented. 8 of those might have been saved with fairly simple TC3 interventions, including 3 that bled to death from an extremity wound with no effective tourniquet application. So the data from the Holcomb study told us that we had work to do. A briefing for the SOCOM leadership was prepared and delivered, and we were successful in getting $7 million of funding for the Tactical Combat Casualty Care Transition Initiative. This was a one-of-a-kind program in military medicine, and the concept was to identify deploying SOF units, to contact these units directly and find out if they in fact had TC3 equipment and if they knew how to use it. And if they didn't, we would supply it to them before they deployed. Needless to say, this was a very ambitious program. And the person that Colonel Holcomb selected to run the program was Sergeant First Class Dom Gradonis. Dom was a Special Forces 18 Delta medic who was then stationed at the ISR, and Dom did a magnificent job. We had training teams from ISR and large containers of TC3 equipment showing up at deploying SOF units. Importantly, Once the units came back from their deployment, Sergeant Guaidonis met with them again to get feedback on how well the equipment and the TC3 concepts worked. So ISR made another critical contribution to getting TC3 launched in special operations by performing a comparative tourniquet study. Colonel Holcomb knew that Army-issued tourniquets did not work, as did every medic in the U.S. military. But we did not know which of the commercially available tourniquets at the time did work. We knew that we wanted to buy non-issued tourniquets for the transition initiative, but the question remained, which tourniquets? And so Colonel Holcomb directed that a comparative study be done. Dr. Tom Walters and his team tested a large group of tourniquets in his laboratory and made some specific recommendations. And as a result, the transition initiative chose the combat application tourniquet. And that was a tourniquet supplied to all of the units in the transition initiative. Shortly thereafter, U.S. SOCOM sent out a message requiring that all deploying SOF units be trained and equipped to do TC3 in combat. Again, credit to then Vice Admiral Eric Olson. His message came out on 22 March 2005. And from that point on, it wasn't optional, it was the standard. To supplement these efforts, then Colonel Doug Robb was the CENTCOM surgeon. He had his commander send out a message that said that anyone deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan would have a CAT tourniquet and a hemostatic dressing. So after TC3 use became widespread in special operations units, the conventional forces saw what was going on, became interested, and they liked it. And so the period 2005 to 2010 was a period of exponential growth for TC3.
Wow, yeah, the change in the last 20 years has just been incredible. And so to summarize it, how is TC3 different from battlefield trauma care that was provided in 1992?
So after the original TC3 project created the first guidelines, for the next 20 years, the guidelines have been under the oversight of the Committee on Tactical Combat Casualty Care. And to mention some, not all, of the things that are currently in the guidelines, medical care and TC3 is phased in the sense that you have to make sure that what you're doing for the patient fits with what's going on in the tactical environment. The saying is, we have to combine good medicine with good tactics because bad tactics can get everybody killed. The aggressive use of COTSI-recommended tourniquets for the initial control of life-threatening extremity hemorrhage is still a cornerstone. But now, when it becomes feasible, we advise people to try to remove the tourniquet in tactical field care or tactical evacuation care. Also, if the first tourniquet doesn't work and you still have bleeding at the site of the injury, then apply a second tourniquet side by side with the first. We recommend using hemostatic dressings to control life-threatening external hemorrhage if you have a site that's non-amenable to tourniquet use. And the recommended dressings include combat gauze, Kyto gauze, and Celox gauze. We recommend junctional tourniquets as an adjunct to external hemorrhage control for junctional bleeding sites, and that includes the axilla and the groin. There's initial management of the airway for casualties with maxillofacial trauma. If they are conscious and able to follow instructions, we have them simply sit up and lean forward if they are able, and thus allow blood to simply drain out of the mouth and thereby clear the airway. If the casualty is unconscious but does not have disrupted anatomy in the oropharynx, nasopharyngeal airway, or an extraglottic airway can be used. If none of those measures work, then the medic can do a surgical airway using the Crike key or other Crike tubes to secure the airway. TC3 recommends aggressive needle thoracostomy with a 14-gauge, 3.25-inch needle for suspected tension pneumothorax. For casualties with an open pneumothorax, we recommend vented chest seals be placed over the site. IV access is attempted only when there's a need for medications or fluid resuscitation. The old days of starting two IVs for everybody with significant trauma are over. If you do need IV access, we recommend a saline lock so that you don't have to hang fluids to keep the vein open. If you need IV access, but you can't get it, then we recommend using intraosseous access. TC3 also recommends 2 grams of tranexamic acid in the pre-hospital phase of care for casualties either in or at risk of hemorrhagic shock or who have sustained significant TBI. And we recommend that that be done as quickly as possible. If your casualty is in shock, the resuscitation fluid of choice is whole blood. And that can be either cold stored, type O, low titer whole blood, which is an FDA approved product, or it can be the fresh type O, low titer whole blood from a pre-screened donor pool, as the 75th Ranger Regiment has pioneered. The old fluids, lactated ringers, normal saline, and Hexden, are all history for tactical combat casualty care as of this month. At the start of the war in Afghanistan, U.S. forces went to war with IM morphine. That's the same battlefield analgesic that they went to war with at Bull Run, Shiloh, and Gettysburg. But IM morphine is very slow to act. And so when the casualty's pain is not promptly relieved, there's the inclination for the medic to administer additional doses of morphine, which may then result in an overdose when the medication finally starts to act. Lastly, opioids like morphine can cause respiratory depression and a drop in blood pressure, which are definitely unwanted effects in a severely injured casualty. Now, safer, faster, and more effective relief of pain from combat wounds is obtained through the use of the TC3 triple option approach to battlefield analgesia. And this was developed at the direct request of medics in our survey of pre-hospital trauma care in Afghanistan in 2012. The medics at that point in time said, "We like all the analgesic options, but we need a clear plan for how to use them." So now, if the casualty's pain is not severe, he or she can continue to engage effectively as a combatant. Option one is the acetaminophen and meloxicam in the combat wound medication pack. These two analgesics don't produce any altered state of consciousness as opioids and ketamine might, and they don't impair platelet function as many other non-steroidal analgesics do. So if the casualty's pain is more severe, but he or she is not in shock, and not suffering from pulmonary compromise, and not at risk of those two conditions, then a good option is option number two, oral transmucosal fentanyl citrate, or OTFC. The 800 microgram transmucosal lozenge formulation is powerful. It works rapidly without having to obtain IV or IO access. This medication was pioneered on the battlefield by Colonels Russ Coatwall and Kevin O'Connor in 2004 and quickly adopted by TC3. Again, as I said before, good ideas wherever they come from. For over 15 years, it has been documented as a safe and effective way to relieve pain on the battlefield. And then the third option, if the casualty has severe pain but is in shock or does have pulmonary compromise, or is judged to be at risk for either, then ketamine is a better option. It's a powerful analgesic. It can be given IV, IO, intramuscular, or intranasal. Ketamine works rapidly, even when given intramuscular, which can be most advantageous in some situations where the medic does not want to have to stop and spend time to gain vascular access. Very importantly, ketamine does not cause respiratory depression, does not cause hypotension, thus preserving the casualty's hemodynamic status. The sublingual formulation of ondansetron is recommended for nausea and vomiting that may result from opioid use or other causes. TC3 recommends preventing hypothermia and the secondary coagulopathy that this condition entails. And that's done through the use of the hypothermia prevention and management kit or other heat-preserving or heat-producing technologies. The antibiotics moxifloxacin or ertapenem are given after life-threatening conditions have been addressed. This helps to reduce preventable deaths as well as wound morbidity from subsequent infections. TC3 encourages the use of tactical scenario-based combat trauma training to help combat medical providers grasp that every tactical situation may present additional challenges to the medic. And these scenarios also serve as a reminder that battlefield trauma care must be consistent always with good small unit tactics and the particulars of each combat situation. And then finally, the Department of Defense Combat Casualty Care Card, DD Form 1380, and the electronic TC3 Medical After Action Report, again, two excellent products developed by the 75th Ranger Regiment, are used to document the care rendered and to help in subsequent after-action reviews that may be conducted to help in the improvement of pre-hospital trauma care.
Well, it sounds like TC3 is very different from the battlefield trauma care of 1992, but how do we know that it's better? In other words, how do we know that TC3 is really saving lives? Do we have data for that?
So that is a great question. It is interesting to recall that when the U.S. military went to war in Afghanistan in 2001, they had no tourniquets, no hemostatic dressings. In 2020, no American warrior goes onto a battlefield without an IFAC that contains both of these devices. The first published report of TC3's success in combat was from the 3rd Infantry Division. And again, this is a quote from a paper by Captain Michael Tarpey that was published in the AMED Journal in 2005. The adoption and implementation of the principles of TC3 by the medical platoon of Task Force 115 in OIF-1 resulted in overwhelming success. Over 25 days of continuous combat with 32 friendly casualties, many of them serious, we had 0 killed in action and 0 died of wounds, while simultaneously caring for a significant number of Iraqi civilian and military casualties. So the next event of note is a credit to Colonel John Craig from the ISR. He did an outstanding job of documenting the impact of pre-hospital extremity tourniquets. And Colonel Craig was stationed at the Ibn Sina Hospital in Baghdad for 7 months in 2006, and his paper in 2008 documents that he had 232 patients who had 428 tourniquets applied on 309 injured limbs. So we know that many tourniquets are not really life-saving, and that was the beauty of what Colonel Craig did. He went down to say, yes, this injury is one that you could have bled to death from, or it's not. And by doing that, he documented that there were 31 lives saved by pre-hospital tourniquets in the 7 months that he did this study. So we know that tourniquets are saving lives in the battlefield. And again, very importantly, he documented that there was no loss of limbs from tourniquet ischemia. A little bit after he did that paper, he was asked by the Army Surgeon General to provide an estimate for how many lives had been saved by tourniquets. And Colonel Craig estimated, based on the number of hospitals and the time involved, that over 1,000 lives had been saved. And so credit to Colonel Craig. Without him, we would likely still be arguing about whether or not tourniquets really work. The next big study was Colonel Brian Eastridge, published a study in 2012 in the Journal of Trauma. Colonel Eastridge was an Army trauma surgeon, consultant to the Army Surgeon General in Trauma, and a former JTS director. And his paper was called Death on the Battlefield. And he went back and reviewed all 4,596 U.S. deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan up to that point in time and found that 87% of those deaths occurred pre-hospital. 24% of those pre-hospital deaths were judged to be potentially preventable. And so a quote from Colonel Eastridge's paper says that the survivability of those injured on the battlefield is at an unprecedented historical level of 90% compared with 84% in Vietnam, and 80% in World War II. Some of the likely factors influencing this improved survivability include advances in personal protective equipment, a deployed trauma system, and improved training of medics and corpsmen based on the concepts of tactical combat casualty care. The next study I'll mention, and the last, is the one by Colonel Russ Cotwall of the 75th Ranger Regiment. His paper was called Eliminating Preventable Death on the Battlefield, because that's what the Rangers did. The 75th Ranger Regiment, who, as you remember, started the war in Afghanistan fully trained in tactical combat casualty care, had zero preventable deaths in the pre-hospital phase of care throughout the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that was based largely on the outstanding command emphasis placed on teaching every member of the regiment to perform TC3 at the appropriate level. So this paper was published in Archives of Surgery in 2011. Again, the U.S. military preventable deaths had been, potentially preventable deaths, had been 24%. The Rangers had a 3% incident of preventable death based on one in-hospital death. Again, zero preventable pre-hospital deaths. A remarkable achievement.
Yeah, to say the least. And so we've talked a lot about TC3 and the Rangers and special operations. How widespread is TC3 within the U.S. military enterprise now?
So the accumulated published evidence and battlefield experience after 19 years of war has at this point in time resulted in all services in the U.S. military, as well as many allied nations, using TC3 concepts to care for their combat wounded. And in 2018, a DoD instruction was published, DoD instruction 1322.24, that established TC3 as the DoD standard of care for all first responders, and mandated that everybody in the DoD receive TC3 training at the appropriate level. Medics get a higher level, obviously, but everybody gets some TC3.
Well, it seems obvious by now that TC3 has implemented a number of changes in battlefield trauma care in its two decades of existence. How do you communicate all of these regular changes to individuals and organizations who are using your product?
So, Alex, strategic messaging has been incredibly important to the success of TC3 for both medical and combat leaders in the U.S. military to make good decisions about trauma care. The COTSI and the Joint Trauma System have an obligation to inform the leadership as well as possible. To use the words of former U.S. Surgeon General Richard Carmona at the Hartford Consensus, individuals and organizations seeking to improve medical care must inform and inspire those who have the authority to mandate those advances in care. And I will take a second to just acknowledge that Surgeon General Carmona took time out from his busy schedule to be a member of the Committee on TC3. He was a Special Forces medic in Vietnam, wounded several times, and just an inspirational figure. For the COTSI, there have been two extremely important partners in our efforts to inform and inspire our user community. The first is the Pre-Hospital Trauma Life Support Manual, PHTLS for short. It's published by the National Association of EMTs, or NAEMT for short, at approximately 3-year intervals. The partnership between TC3 and NAEMT was established by the late Dr. Norman McSwain. He was one of the 26 individuals, by the way, who reviewed the original TC3 paper before it came out. And then, after it came out in 1998, he helped arrange to get TC3 into the PHTLS manual, which is the Bible for pre-hospital trauma care in the civilian sector. The trauma care recommendations in the PHTLS manual carry the triple endorsement of the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma, the NAEMT, and the COTSI. And there's no other set of battlefield trauma care guidelines ever that has received this triple endorsement. Each new edition of the PHTLS manual contains the latest updates to the TC3 changes. So that's been a tremendous vehicle for communication. The second critically important strategic messaging partner has been the Journal of Special Operations Medicine, JSOM. Since 2013, every change in the TC3 guidelines that has been made has been published in the JSOM. The JSOM leadership has been extremely cooperative in helping to get the evidence that supports TC3 changes and the changes themselves published as quickly as possible. This consistency has been very helpful. Our users know where to look to find the latest information on TC3, and the place to look is the JSOM. The fact that JSOM is indexed in PubMed is very helpful to users looking for updates. Once medical articles are included in the Index Medicus and searchable on PubMed, they'll be there permanently. So future researchers can go back and understand why the COTSI did what it did about a specific aspect of care at a specific point in time. The JSOM also publishes COTSI meeting minutes and many other items of TC3 interest. This is a great assist in TC3 messaging, so we are very grateful to the JSOM for its strong support. And I'd like to offer a personal thank you from me to Michelle Landers and her outstanding staff.
And that's wonderful. Thanks. And so we've been talking a lot about your military customers. How about, has TC3 been transitioned to use at all in the civilian sector?
The 20-year partnership between NAEMT and TC3 and the American College of Surgeons has enabled the military and the civilian sectors to work seamlessly to share advances in pre-hospital trauma care. So TC3-based pre-hospital training is now widespread in the U.S. civilian sector, and that's thanks largely to several organizations who have been working for years to transition these concepts. And notable among those is Dr. Linworth Jacobs, who is a trauma surgeon in Hartford, Connecticut. After his personal experiences with a mass casualty scenario, the shootings at Sandy Hook, he became inspired to try to transition all of the things that the military had done into the civilian sector and to get American College of Surgeons support for those innovations. And he did that through the Hartford Consensus Working Group and later on through the White House-sponsored and American College of Surgeons-sponsered Stop the Bleed campaign.
And earlier you'd mentioned some new changes that are coming out as of this month. Can you tell us about some other new directions that TC3 is currently undertaking?
Well, one thing that hasn't changed since T3 started is that the goal remains zero preventable deaths. So the latest concept that has been developed is called Advanced Resuscitative Care. And if you go back and relook at Estridge's 2012 study on preventable deaths in combat, sort those out by, let's assume, 100 preventable combat deaths, according to Estridge's data. For every 100 servicemen or women that die, 7 of those were due to airway obstruction. 1 was due to a tension pneumothorax, and the other 92 were due to hemorrhage. 12 of those were due to extremity hemorrhage, which we now have pretty well covered. 18 were due to junctional hemorrhage, which we now have pretty well covered. But then 62 of the deaths, again out of 100, are due to non-compressible torso hemorrhage. And of those, remembering that the chest and the back are enclosed, hopefully, in ceramic plates, 40 of those 62 preventable deaths are due to abdominal pelvic bleeding and could be saved by advanced resuscitative care if that's done quickly. So there are two components to advanced resuscitative care. First is to use whole blood for resuscitation, and the second is far forward REBOA, resuscitative endovascular balloon occlusion of the aorta. And that entails inserting a catheter, running it up your aorta, and inflating a balloon to stop the blood flow so that it will not be lost to distal hemorrhage. Let's look first at whole blood for hemorrhagic shock. That is a proven lifesaver. That was shown in the 2009 study by Spinella, and more recently, just this year, by the 2020 study by Colonel Jennifer Gurney. Both of those studies found that early fresh whole blood saves lives. There's no golden hour for internal hemorrhage. For whole blood and for Reboa to be effective, they have to be undertaken as soon as possible before the casualties and irreversible shock. The majority of U.S. ground forces still do not have whole blood at the point of injury, but this is changing rapidly. The second facet of ARC is Reboa. And again, minutes matter here as well. Many people bleeding internally die within the first 30 minutes. With Reboa, you are able to insert the catheter to a place just above the diaphragm and stop all bleeding below the diaphragm. That is admittedly a pretty aggressive intervention, but if you meet the TC3 criteria for initiating Reboa, you are already well on your way to bleeding to death. So we only undertake it when a casualty is in extremis and failing to respond to whole blood resuscitation. The COTSI has developed a customized plan for far-forward Reboa. I will emphasize that advanced resuscitative care requires a forward resuscitative team. It is not an individual skill for either a medic or a physician or a PA. It takes more than two hands to do all these things. We're making headway with ARC in the Department of Defense. The Joint Special Operations Command fielded this capability in October of 2018. The U.S. Marine Corps has submitted the requirements documents to acquire this capability as of March of last year. The U.S. Army Critical Care Flight Paramedic Task Selection Board, at the initiative of First Sergeant Matt Harmon, has recommended that Reboa balloon management be a critical skill added to the paramedics' flight skills.
That's great. That's definitely a 50-meter view. And how about more of a 300-meter view? What do you foresee for the COTSI going forward?
So, Alec, at this point in time, COTSI is a component of the Joint Trauma System, the lead agency for trauma in the Department of Defense. Colonel Stacy Shackelford, an Air Force trauma surgeon, is our chief. Dr. Marianne Spott is the deputy director, and Marianne has been the corporate knowledge for the Joint Trauma System. She's been there since they opened the doors. The Joint Trauma System, in turn, is a component of the Defense Health Agency. The COTSI, in particular, is one of three committees on the Joint Trauma System Defense Committee on Trauma, which is chaired by Colonel Jennifer Gurney, who I mentioned before. But this is the military counterpart to the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma. I'm happy to report that the COTSI is going to have superb leadership going forward. Captain Brendan Drew is now serving as the chairman of the committee. Captain Drew is the first Marine Expeditionary Force surgeon and the Navy Surgeon General's specialty leader for emergency medicine. Captain Drew has served with both Marine Corps and Special Operations Advanced Resuscitative Teams in the pre-hospital combat environment, and so personally has seen TC3 concepts in action for many years. And I just have to add once more that Captain Drew undertook these duties in addition to the two full-time jobs that he already had. So again, God bless all the people that are willing to go above and beyond to improve pre-hospital trauma care for our combat wounded. The COTSI also now has a vice chair in the person of retired Master Sergeant Monty Montgomery. Monty is a former U.S. SOCOM senior enlisted medical advisor. He was the former senior medic for the 75th Ranger Regiment, and his vast experience as a Ranger combat medic will be invaluable to Captain Drew and to the COTSI going forward.
Well, sir, that has been a whirlwind of an education. And as we wrap things up, do you have any final thoughts for those of our service members out there putting themselves in harm's way to keep us safe here on the home front?
Absolutely. Again, most of the individuals who serve on the COTSI, the TC3 Working Group, and the other JTS Combat Trauma Committees aren't assigned to the JTS. They volunteer their time and expertise to help in the effort to improve combat casualty care. To quote Colonel Jeff Bailey, who is one of our former directors, "The greatest resource that the JTS has is the many men and women who so generously donate their time and talents to help with the JTS mission. So, a heartfelt thanks to all of those individuals for helping to conceive of, develop, and implement all of the remarkable advances in battlefield trauma care that have been made since a conflict in Afghanistan began. And with respect to TC3, special thanks always to the combat medics, corpsmen, and PJs. They are the courageous individuals who take all of the TC3 concepts onto the battlefield and use them to save lives. Again, thanks for the chance to be with you today."
Wow, that was amazing. Thank you so much for putting this together for us. That is just an incredible resource for those young folks out there new to the field. And can't thank you enough for your time and insight, Captain Retired Dr. Frank Butler. Thanks so much for joining us today, sir.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.